May it please the Court, I'm Ray Reisner. I represent Donald DeChristopher and Martha DeChristopher, who were clients of Enterprise Trust Company. Also representing the appellants is James Marsh, and his client is Mr. Cochran. Time permitting, what I'd like to do is address three primary arguments: a brief background of Enterprise and their trading practices, why it is that we believe the DeChristophers should be treated like what are categories of other investors to the extent that the SEC or the receiver's proposed distribution plan is followed, and finally, why we believe the proposed plan of distribution is, in fact, in error. I'm obviously ready to answer any questions that the Court may have, including any questions.
I notice your list leaves off what is the antecedent question, whether we have appellate jurisdiction. Perhaps we should start there.
Be happy to. That was just what I was getting ready to say, that happy to answer any questions with respect to that. With respect to the standing issue, Your Honor, what we believe...
It's a question of standing. It's a question of jurisdiction.
Understood. With respect to whether or not, as a non-party, we have the ability to pursue this appeal, what we would suggest is that the law is very clear that generally a non-party cannot, but there are exceptions to that. What the exceptions normally revolve around are certain policy considerations. The policy considerations are whether or not
policy considerations can affect jurisdiction. That's about the clearest message one can possibly get from the Supreme Court, that jurisdiction is antecedent to any consideration of policy. And your problem is, of course, our holding in SEC against Wozniak now 15 years ago in what appears to be an identical situation. We held there was no jurisdiction. Unless we overrule Wozniak, I don't know how anything is going to happen here.
I think that Wozniak can be distinguished on two grounds. The first ground is, in Wozniak, the party there waited until the distribution, the money had already been distributed, and everything had already been concluded.
What does that have to do with appellate jurisdiction?
Your Honor, I think it has to do with whether or not exceptions to that general rule should be applied or should not be applied. In Wozniak, they noted that there are some exceptions to the general rule as to whether or not a party or a non-party can participate, whether or not a de facto party can participate. I refer you to the HOMA decision, which postdated Wozniak. In the HOMA decision, it appears to us that what the Seventh Circuit left open was the question whether or not, when there was a process that was created, like the process that was created here, and a party fully participated in the process, like the DeChristophers fully participated in the process here, whether or not the party would, in fact, have standing. There in the HOMA decision...
What standing has to do with this counsel?
I apologize. I misspoke. As to whether or not a party would have jurisdiction, whether or not a party would be able to pursue the appeal. Here, Your Honor... In Woolman, what they talked about is how the Fifth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit have reached the conclusion that parties that are participating in a receivership process similar to the one here did, in fact, have the ability to pursue the appeal. They did have the jurisdictional basis.
We disagreed with them. Now, if I were in your position, I would be arguing something like, that Wozniak is inconsistent with the Supreme Court's later decision in Devlin against Scardelletti. We relied in Wozniak on Marino against Ortiz, which I notice you never mentioned, and perhaps Devlin could be understood as modifying the approach of Marino. But your briefs don't mention Devlin. Are you relying in any way on Devlin?
Your Honor, we were not relying on Devlin, but I think that Devlin can be used here. The point that we were relying on was really the point that was made in HOMA, which is there they said, we haven't decided, we don't have to get to the issue as to whether or not that party had jurisdiction to pursue the appeal here. We believe that decision basically suggests that the court had left open the question as to whether or not we would, in fact, have jurisdiction to...
You know, counsel, we have a rule against your even citing HOMA. It's an unpublished order. The rule of this circuit forbids counsel to cite or discuss unpublished orders. We have only one published opinion on this subject. It's Wozniak.
Your Honor, focusing on Wozniak itself, what we would suggest to you is that Wozniak is different there the party did not have a procedure by which they could fully participate in the lower court, similar to the procedure that was created there. In Wozniak, you did not have someone, as we did, file motions, appear for argument, file briefs. Here, for example, before the lower court...
Why would that matter? In that the people... I trust, remember the reasoning of Wozniak. We followed what we understood to be the Supreme Court's holding in Marino against Ortiz. In Marino, the people who appealed had filed briefs and participated. The Second Circuit had relied on its earlier decision in an SEC receivership case. And the Supreme Court disapproved the proposition that investors in a receivership case could appeal and reversed the Second Circuit's decision in Marino. Now, I don't understand how the distinctions you're making, given the genesis of this doctrine and the Supreme Court's holding in Marino, can possibly matter.
Your Honor, I do believe that the distinctions matter in terms of how this is to be applied. And we do believe that this issue...
You're suggesting that this be... Wozniak be distinguished on a ground that the Supreme Court expressly rejected in Marino. That can't be a ground of distinction that we will follow. The only thing I can think of from your perspective is to make some argument based on Devlin, but so far you have not done so.
Your Honor, if I could, let's just talk for a minute about what the practical application would be. If, in fact, the appeal were to be dismissed... for a lack of jurisdiction. We believe that the net effect would be that we would return to the lower court, we would seek to...
No, that won't happen. There's a timeliness requirement. You can't intervene in 2009 to appeal a decision that became final in 2008. Right? Out of time? This is a non-starter.
If, in fact, that were to be the application that this court believes to be correct, given the subsequent decisions that have occurred and given the activities of sister circuits and how they've addressed this issue, we believe that the net effect of this is to basically suggest to the Christophers that there is no procedure, basically, by which they can, as the parties primarily affected by this ruling, effectively participate and get to...
You can do what we held in Wozniak. You intervene in the district court and then appeal to the Court of Appeals.
Your Honor...
That's the law of the Seventh Circuit. It tells you exactly what to do.
Well, obviously there were parties that attempted to intervene and those motions for intervention were denied. The extent that we...
To intervene is denied incorrectly. You can appeal from that.
Certainly, the district court treated us as if we were parties to the extent that they actually granted our motion to withhold the distribution of the funds here pending this appeal. And the receiver did not oppose that based upon any theory that, in fact, we did not have the ability to pursue the appeal. I don't think I have anything else of substance to add to the issue that we are discussing. So if I could, I would turn to the question of sort of the enterprise trading background itself.
Certainly.
With respect to the enterprise trading background, essentially what you had was you had trading that occurred you had trading that occurred where the accounts were margined, where the allocation occurred late, where that information was concealed from customers. They were not aware of what was occurring with respect to those items. And to that extent, what you had was not, in fact, anything that the customers had good information in terms of what was occurring for them. The argument that is being made here by the receiver and was adopted by the trial court is that, in fact, what you had was that the clients, like the DeChristophers, wanted a level of trading risk, and they wanted the level of trading risk that actually appeared in their accounts. We disagree with that conclusion. I think that the clearest example is when you take a look at how what they referred to as other accounts versus the what they referred to as managed accounts were. When you talk about something that was a quote-unquote managed account, perhaps I can address that a little bit in the rebuttal time that I have remaining to me.
Certainly, counsel. Ms. Marsh. Mr. Marsh, I'm sorry.
Good morning, Your Honors. I do represent Mr. David Cochran, who's here. He's one of the victims of Enterprise's fraud. We have adopted in large part the position of the DeChristophers, and just a couple points I'd like to make in my limited time with respect to supplementing Mr. Reasoner's arguments. From our perspective, Your Honors, the most compelling issue here is that the receiver and the district court missed a chance to do what was fair and equitable as the law pertaining to distribution of assets to fraud victims requires in a case such as this. If the funds remaining after the fraud were distributed pro rata to the account holders, each would get at least half of their contributions back, 51% in the receiver's calculations. The difference between such a pro rata distribution and the district court's ultimate allocation to the custodial account holders is the difference between 60% and the 51%. The difference, however, to so-called managed account holders, including Mr. Cochran, is the difference between what would have been 51% and ultimately 23%. The effect of this, what we think is a massively disproportionate allocation, is to force Mr. Cochran and others similarly situated to lose almost 80% of their life savings, making it impossible for them to salvage a living benefit from their lifetime of savings. If the pro rata distribution rule had been followed and not violated by what we think is an illogical and incorrect fault assessment by the district court, all of the account holders would walk away with at least half of their life savings intact. If the district court had done the right thing, and we're asking this court to consider that pro rata allocation is proper and reverse the district court, the difference to custodial account holders would be relatively negligible, obviously still a significant amount of money, but the difference, a 9% difference. The difference to managed account holders such as Mr. Cochran would be life-changing. Mr. Cochran will, at 73 years old, be able to at least get by on a 51% distribution of his contribution as opposed to now 23%, which makes it essentially impossible for him to retire at any time in the foreseeable future. We do think that all of Enterprise Trust victims were similarly situated because they were similarly victimized. None of the account holders knew of this speculative secret trading practice occurring within the accounts. They all were actively deceived about the nature of the trading going on. None of them knew about margin trading and aggressive short selling and option trading in these accounts, and none of the account holders willingly took the risk that directly resulted in the losses to all of them. We think that the pro rata distribution rule had to be followed because the exceptional circumstances necessary to prevent it from applying are not here. The only circumstances that were detailed in the receiver's report and the district court's decision to justify deviating from pro rata for the distributions to all of the account holders that everyone acknowledged were victims of this fraud and justify these completely disproportionate distributions that resulted in hundreds of thousands of dollars of losses to some clients as compared to others, were that Mr. Cochran and others like him were partly culpable for causing the losses because they received account statements. And that essentially is the crux of the decision that differentiated the different types of account holders was these account statements. In fact, the district court said that these account statements showed high activity with extensive short-selling options transactions and margin trading that were unmitigated by written objections by the account holders. So the essential question then is what did these account statements really say? And I would urge the court to look at these account statements that the receiver and the district court felt were the difference maker in this case and imputed to unsophisticated investors complicity in the fraud that was suffered by all account holders. The account statements that were made part of the receiver's response to Mr. Cochran's objection and are thus part of the record were provided nothing more than a list of securities and in some cases mutual funds that were purchased by Enterprise with Mr. Cochran's contributions. None of these statements revealed to Mr. Cochran or other unsophisticated investors, that Enterprise was trading on margin, engaging in derivative option trading, or aggressively shorting stocks. So we think the premise of the entire decision is faulty because these account statements, which were the difference maker, didn't provide that information that the court said they provided to investors such as Mr. Cochran.
Were those account statements showing a value?
They did, Your Honor. They showed a value.
And I assume it varied from statement to statement.
They varied from statement to statement. And, in fact, the court said that we somehow should have mitigated the losses or been aware of them. But the fact is these losses were actually hidden from investors such as Mr. Cochran, so he couldn't have mitigated a loss that was concealed from him. I see that my time is out, and my time is up, and I thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Marsh. Mr. Gerland.
May it please the Court, good morning, Your Honors, Counsel, Mr. Receiver, and, of course, all the investors who are here, both those who are represented and unrepresented. I want to address the questions the Court raised about Devlin, because I do think that's important. But before I do that, I'd like to take a minute just to put this receivership in context for the Court. From the date that Judge Zagel appointed the receiver on March 3rd until a final plan of distribution relating to over 600 individual investors was put into place and approved, a mere 7 months had passed. And I say a mere 7 months because during that time, hundreds of thousands of transactions had to be reviewed and analyzed by the accountants. There were approximately 1,198 accounts that got reviewed. As I said, there were roughly 600-plus investors. And during that period of time, there were more objections than the two before this Court. There were, in fact, 98 objections. All those objections were compiled for the Court along with trading records, were put into a database that the Court could review electronically, and the time was taken to do that. And at the end of that seven-month process, in a relatively short period of time, we have three investors who are unhappy. This is a situation, Your Honors, where no one's going to be happy because there is a significant shortfall. You can't please all the people all the time, but the Court did a great job, and not to state the obvious.
We need to get to jurisdiction before we discuss the merits.
With respect to the jurisdictional issue, Your Honor, state the obvious. Rules are rules. The rule that a party must enter.
Well, there's no question what Wozniak holds. The real question, as I was attempting to suggest to Mr. Reznor, is whether Wozniak is consistent with the Supreme Court's later decision in Devlin against Scardelletti. There's a footnote in your brief which says Devlin is irrelevant, doesn't make any argument along those lines. But why isn't Devlin relevant? In what way is the investor affected by a receivership different from a class member? In what material way is the investor different?
Well, first, and as we do say, I do believe Devlin is distinguishable because it does concern the rights of a member pursuant to Federal Rule 23. But I believe there is a difference, and the difference is that the investors in Devlin, their rights and all of their rights are being adjudicated with finality. They will not be able to bring actions to
Well, isn't that equally true here?
No,
the investors' interests in the assets of this firm are being determined with finality. They can't bring a separate lawsuit and claim more.
That's true, but they can bring lawsuits against third parties. There are investor lawsuits proceeding against third parties.
But there's nothing about third parties before us here. The point I'm making, what seems relevant from the perspective of Devlin, is that the investor's interest in this estate are being determined with finality. There's no other litigation they can bring. There's no other claim they can bring. Their goose is cooked.
And I would disagree to the extent that there are other litigations that could be brought. Some investors have sued. In fact, we have also sued recently Allegiant, which was a clearing company.
Of course, you can sue somebody else, but this is not an appeal about somebody else. This is an appeal about their interest in this estate. Right? And do we agree or not that that has been determined with finality, that there's no other legal remedy available to them about this estate?
I agree that at the conclusion of the receivership, those assets will be distributed and they effectively will not be able to.
All right. Now, the other thing that came to my mind in thinking about this is the analogy to bankruptcy practice. Suppose this had been a bankruptcy and the account holders would be creditors in the bankruptcy. Would they need to intervene formally in the bankruptcy, or is it enough for them to file a notice of claim? And if their notice of claim is written down, to appeal?
I'm not a bankruptcy attorney, so I don't know that I can
answer. I think the answer is intervention is not necessary in bankruptcy. It's enough to file a notice of claim.
And if I may, Your Honor, the primary distinction, though, between this case and a bankruptcy is that this is an equity receivership. And the point that I was driving at initially with going through the history of the receivership is that the broad brushstrokes that the district court has to make, the summary proceedings, which in effect decide rights for many, in a summary fashion, are necessary in an equity receivership. They're critical because the whole goal of the receivership is to, as efficiently and quickly as possible, return assets to the investors and preserve those to the extent possible along the way. So I would submit that there's a very significant difference between this and a bankruptcy or this situation in a class action where you've got a very broad group of people, a diverse group of people, a very real need to return those assets as quickly as possible, and you do rely on the court more in an equity receivership than you do in the other areas Your Honor's referring to. And in this case, the point I was making originally is that in a very short period of time, we've been able to, with significant help from the SEC and with significant oversight from the court, come up with a plan that has essentially satisfied 99% of those affected by it. And while we are here dealing with issues concerning three investors, there are 600 other plus investors who are waiting for their distribution, and they're still waiting for that distribution because of the appeal and because of that issue. I do think that with regard to the rule about intervention, it is a rule. It's an important rule. It is no less important than the rule that says that if you don't file a notice of appeal in 30 days, you can't appeal. The process exists. It's easy to follow. And indeed, Your Honor, there was an investor in this case who moved to intervene at the objection stage, and Judge Zagel told that investor, no need to intervene in order to object. I'm going to hear your objections. But if you're dissatisfied and you want to appeal, make a motion to intervene, and I will consider it. That investor chose not to move to intervene. These investors chose not to move intervene, and in doing so deprived the court of an important screening process. And I would submit that rule, which aids the efficient administration of the court, is no different than the notice rule or any other rules along those lines. If there are no further questions, thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Lebowski.
May it please the Court, I plan to only address the appellant's arguments that my firm, Howry, should not have been paid $75,000 for the work done in this matter. There's absolutely no dispute that the services rendered by Howry were necessary, appropriate, valuable, and far exceeded the $75,000 requested and approved. There's absolutely no dispute that Howry timely and properly sought the fees and costs, and that the receiver reviewed all of the billing records and all of the attendant documents and was satisfied that it was appropriate to pay Howry a percentage less than any other claimant is getting in this matter. There are several procedural and substantive reasons why the appellant's appeal on our motion for fees and costs is not well-founded. In addition to the jurisdictional issues that the court has already noted, and I'll try to answer any questions, but I want to move on to the other points. Appellant Cochran never objected to Howry's motion at any point in time. Just never did. First time it came up was under what he believes to be a Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 28I argument that he gets to adopt a co-appellant's argument. I'm not aware of any case or any practice that allows a co-appellant's brief to satisfy your obligation to raise issues below before you can appeal them. The case cited, Smith-Klein-Beacham, certainly doesn't say that. It states exactly what Rule 28I of the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure state, that if you raise something below, you don't need to make the complete argument above. You can adopt a co-appellant's argument. So Cochran's appeal should be dismissed not only because there is no jurisdiction over his appeal, but also he can't raise these issues on appeal for the first time. Shifting for a moment to the procedural deficiencies with the DeChristopher's appeal, in addition to the court's lack of jurisdiction, the arguments made in this court were never made below. They're trying to argue that either Nevada law, which they state in a footnote ought to apply by fiat, saying they've concluded it ought to apply. That was never addressed below. They cite one 1930s Nevada case on whatever Nevada banking law happened to be at that point in time about whether certain state agencies were special depositors or not. Interestingly, the court found they weren't special depositors and rely on two Illinois cases. Illinois law was never argued below, and a federal ERISA case out of this court on whether a bank could grab an IRA to satisfy a guarantee obligation. None of those were raised below. What was raised below in one paragraph in a 17-page objection was somehow granting Howery's motion was inappropriate because, in their mind, all the money belonged solely to customers, not to any creditors or other service providers without distinguishing amongst them, and it ought to be paid pro rata. The trial court, as a court of equity under the federal securities law, considered what was in front of it, looked at everything, made a judgment. I believe the substantive legal issue, if the court wants to go past all of the procedural hurdles both Mr. Cochran and the DeChristophers have, is whether or not Judge Zagel abused his discretion in laying out, pursuant to what the receiver had, a plan whereby certain people get paid according to categories that were put in. Howery was put into the lesser category of anybody and got $75,000 out of almost $390,000 to that date in fees and costs. There's really no basis for either one of these appeals. There's no procedural basis, there's no legal basis, and there's really nothing that has been said either in this argument or in either of the briefs that really justify filing the appeal on Judge Zagel's grant of our motion for fees and costs. Unless the court has any questions, I don't have any other comments.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Lebowski. Anything further, Mr. Reznor?
Yes, sir.
I'd like to address 3 points briefly. The first is counsel for the receiver has started with an argument of the exhaustive review that they made of the account statements. We don't disagree that they did review the account statements thoroughly. We just indicate that that is the reason why we believe that the plan of distribution is incorrect. They're relying on account statements to determine what level of risk customers wanted. Clients like the DeChristophers did not want risk consistent with the trading that actually occurred. They filed a detailed affidavit. They filed supporting documents that related that affidavit, and they filed them on a timely basis to indicate that what occurred in their account was not what they wanted. What happened is when they asked questions, they were lied to about what was actually occurring. For example, all three of their accounts are IRA accounts. IRA accounts cannot be traded on margin. Was never disclosed when they were being traded on margin. They were told that their trading was consistent with an IRA account. They were planning to retire. They asked that no speculative trades be put in their account. There were speculative trades. To the extent that they asked questions about option transactions that occurred, what they were given was a story about a covered call writing option program that actually reduced the risk of the trading. The fact that they were lied to and that they believe the lies does not mean that somehow they have agreed to a higher level of risk than other people that did not have speculative trades placed in their account. This trading was not being done for the benefit of the customers that occurred here. The trading was being done in order to catch up for the earlier losses that were sustained so as to conceal the fraud, and it was an active fraud where the account holders were deliberately lied to about what was in their accounts.
Were your clients ever able to withdraw any money?
They never tried to withdraw any money.
Do you know of others that did?
There certainly were people, and when they withdrew, it's like a classic Ponzi scheme. They got what their account statement said that they had, even though that money shouldn't have been available to them. What you had here, Your Honor, if I can shift to the second argument, which is the money that was paid to Howery. The point of that money is not that it's a lot of money, that it's $75,000, but Howery is a general creditor. The only money that was left at the end was investor money. Enterprise didn't have money left over, so a general creditor takes after the special deposits. So whether you look at Nevada law, whether you look at Illinois law, whether you look at federal common law, it is very clear that IRA money like the Christophers had are special deposits, and they take first over the general creditors. The only argument that was really made with respect to that issue was an argument made by the Receiver's Council. An argument for the Receiver's Council was, well, administrative costs you can pay out of the proceeds of the investors. Well, that's correct, except that these were not administrative expenses. They weren't close to administrative expenses because they were incurred before the receiver was ever appointed. They weren't being done to marshal the assets for purposes of distribution. And finally, Your Honor, I know it was an argument that was made relatively in passing with respect to the jurisdictional issue, but let me address this. Counsel for the receiver suggested that here there is some way out by way of the investors. What they can do is they can sue other third parties for the actions that occurred and recoup some of their money that way, and to that extent they're not really bound by or totally controlled by what happens in this proceeding. That is inaccurate, and they should know it to be inaccurate. They have recently entered into a settlement with one brokerage company. In conjunction with that settlement, what they have suggested to the court is that there should be a bar order that would bar the investors from pursuing claims against that brokerage company. Now, admittedly, the district court has not as of yet ruled on the settlement, nor has it ruled on the application of that bar order, but it is certainly an indication that there would, in fact, be a final adjudication that occurred here. And finally, what I'd like to do is just note, we are representing the DeChristophers without charge to them, and the reason why we were doing that is because we believe that the issues that are addressed here are important. We believe that the reason why the other people haven't appealed here is not because they agree with what has occurred here, but because it is basically cost prohibitive given the amount of money that is in controversy. And the final thing I would say is I apologize to the court to the extent that I was not able to be articulate with respect to the Devlin issues or whatever. We would certainly invite the court, if you would permit us, to file a short supplemental statement with respect to Devlin. But what we are trying to do is address a method of distribution that is unheard of. There is no other receivership that has tried to make a determination about what level of risk clients wanted by looking at account statements that are inaccurate, and we believe that it would in fact be inappropriate to do so.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.